Well, Francesca's currently on an Australian and New Zealand embassy-supported charter flight back home, arriving later today. When I spoke to her late last week, she was still awaiting to hear whether that flight was going to happen. And she was speaking to us from the foothills of the Ecuadorian Andes, where she's been staying.
Yeah. Internet's not the best down here where we are in the community in the valley, so I'm sitting up on the roof, actually, under the stars. It's just after 7 p.m. here.
What a lovely image to have in the first instance. However, these are really difficult times. And what's the situation you are in? Were you simply unable to come back to New Zealand when you wanted?
Yes. So, I mean, I guess, well, like thousands of people, really, we've become stuck on the other side of the world, in this case, the other side of the Pacific Ocean, from where we want to be. We're in Ecuador with no confirmed way of getting back to New Zealand. I suppose what is different in our situation was, firstly, we weren't on holiday. We were in Ecuador for work. And we were conducting conservation work on a critically endangered species in a very isolated place out on the northwest of Isabella Island on the Galapagos Islands, where we'd gone out there at the end of February, at which time there was no coronavirus recorded in Ecuador. And we were camping on the beach, expecting to stay there for over 9 weeks to conduct really intensive conservation to save the chicks of the mangrove finch. And out there we just have a satellite phone, which we really use for logistical updates when necessary, and of course in the case of emergencies. So we're very remote out there. We were probably as safe as anybody could be in terms of being isolated from the pandemic, but we had no way of really knowing what was unfolding in other parts of the world, in New Zealand, in Ecuador, and how it was going to impact us so drastically.
Just how bad have things been in Ecuador and in parts of the country in particular?
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, Ecuador has been hit really hard. And obviously, there's been a lot of news, international news, mainly focusing on Guayaquil, which is the largest city in Ecuador down on the coast. It's, you know, very densely populated, a lot of the city. A lot of the people living, you know, in really close proximity to one another in very simple houses, in temperatures that easily reach over 30 degrees. So, you know, even when the government in Ecuador did enforce curfews, which have been, you know, the military and police have been out in force to try and enforce those, it's not as easy as what a lot of us in New Zealand or, you know, even up here in the mountains would think of when we're told to stay at home. And I think that's definitely been part of the problem with the spread there. And I think generally, you know, Ecuador, it's a wonderful country and there's so many great initiatives, but things like, you know, the healthcare system is, you know, like most places in the world, always under a bit of stress. And when you have a real emergency, it just gets overwhelmed. And on top of that, it's been very hard to initiate really sort of thorough, fast testing for the virus. So there's actually a lot of uncertainty around the actual death toll from the virus here in Ecuador. It seems to be there's been a lot of mortality that it's unconfirmed what has actually caused it.
Tell me about where you are staying right now. This is a small community in the Andes.
Yeah, so we're up at 2,800 metres in Salasaca in central Ecuador. It's a small indigenous community. Ecuador has amazing diversity of indigenous cultures and peoples. I think there's 14 recognized different indigenous cultures in Ecuador. I'm here with my husband, who is Salasacan, and our three-year-old son. We came here because by the time the national park got us out of the field in Galapagos, there was no longer any way to continue to New Zealand. And we're very lucky in that we have a small house here in the community. And the community, I understand, similar to some Māori communities in New Zealand, actually took matters into their own hands very early on and set up pretty severe roadblocks in all entrances and exits to the community and have tried to isolate themselves in that way. And so people here live on from subsistence agriculture, and the, you know, the sort of curfews here don't really cause much change in daily life. People are able to stay pretty much to themselves but still access their crops and their fields and, you know, get food to their animals. So really we're in, feel very lucky that we're in a sort of little tranquil bubble here where day to day life is really very peaceful.
Tell me more about this community and their lifestyles in normal times. Is it a pretty special place to be?
Yeah, I think Salisaka is an amazing place. It's distance-wise, it's not very far from what is a massively quickly growing city of Ambato, but they're incredibly, they stick together really well, and they've managed to hold on to a lot of their really important traditions. They're defined, I guess, firstly by their language. The first language of all Salisakans is Salisakan Quechua. So here, when I'm with Jorge, my husband's family, that's the language spoken in the house. The children learn Spanish at school. And they've kept their traditional clothing, which is hand-woven out of wool, incredibly finely woven. Women here, you know, they work hard in the fields, they carry massive loads on their back, but at the same time, if their hands aren't busy, even if they're walking along a really steep-sided valley, they'll have the spindle in their hand and be spinning that really fine wool, which is then woven into the traditional poncho for the men, or what's called an anako, a very long woolen skirt for the women, and very brightly coloured shawls.
This is the home of the alpaca, is it? Is this a very key part of the culture, obviously, but also the economy?
Yeah, I mean, originally, certainly, because pre the arrival of the Spaniards into South America, of course, it was llamas and alpacas which everybody lived off. Here it's more now moved to sheep for wool, just because they're easier to keep on the kind of pasture grasses that are now grown. And also most people have a cow, usually for milk, and they also keep pigs. So animals and subsistence agriculture are really the basis for the community. But of course, you know, younger generations, like everywhere as well, there's more opportunities. Education has increased, and that comes with opportunities for other work. And there's also been quite significant migration out of the community, both to Europe, to America, and also within Ecuador. A lot of people go to Galapagos to earn higher wages.
What of the culture? Because there's the traditional Inca culture, but I think there is also a strong vein of Catholicism as well. And how does this influence festivals and people's rituals and relationships?
Yeah, I think it makes for a huge number of festivals and celebrations and public holidays. So really, obviously, with the arrival of the Spaniards sort of, you know, over 500 years ago here, they brought Catholicism and they converted as many of the indigenous cultures as they could. And I guess part of Catholicism is that it sort of embraced what already existed in terms of their traditional religions, which were based more on Pachamama, the earth mother. And on that sort of, you know, annual cycle. which is related very closely to harvest and times when plants are most productive. And Catholicism embraced all that, and they've sort of now got a sort of Catholic calendar of the year, which of course we can relate to a lot in terms of New Zealand with, you know, Easter public holidays and Christmas and things like that. But they've combined those with the traditional elements, so you get an incredible sort of vibrance at these celebrations, which I think it is really special, and it's also something that the community really identify with. And you'll find, you know, people will travel across the world to come home at those dates to be here for those festivals. So it is exceptionally important to them.
How did your connection begin with this part of the world? Was it Galapagos and conservation work that was the initial entree?
It was before that, actually. I was a AFS exchange student to Colombia when I was 18 years old, and went there after finishing high school in New Zealand and lived there for a year and learned Spanish. I'd always had a passion for conservation and birds, and done a lot of that as, you know, voluntary stuff during my school years. So I returned to New Zealand, studied and worked, and always had the desire to return to South America. And I spent a year traveling and did a lot of voluntary conservation work here in different countries. And then a job opportunity came up in Galapagos. And I guess to me, it really combined my interest in South America with bird conservation. And that's when I moved from New Zealand and lived permanently in Galapagos from 2009 until 2016.
Our guest is Francesca Cunningham, a New Zealander who is at the moment with her family on the edge of Salasaka as a result of the pandemic. You are listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. So explain more about this conservation work that you are doing in the Galapagos with the mangrove finch.
Yes, so it's a project I've been employed with the Charles Darwin Foundation, which is a conservation and research NGO based in Puerto Oro on the Galapagos. It's a project which is run in partnership with the Galapagos National Park, so that's the equivalent of Department of Conservation in New Zealand. And the mangrove finch itself, it's the rarest bird in Galapagos. It's the rarest bird in Ecuador. There's about 100 of them left in the world. We know there's fewer than 20 breeding pairs. We had 14 pairs which nested and laid eggs this year. It was worse the year before. We only had 10. And they're all confined to just 30 hectares, tiny little patches of mangroves on the northwest coast of one island. And they're threatened, like many species in New Zealand, by introduced species. Introduced rats predate the nests, which of course to us New Zealanders is a familiar scenario. Because they're in such a small area, we're able to effectively control the rats, and there's been, you know, work in place there with the Galapagos National Park for over 10 years now, which has been really successful at reducing nest predation. But what is a problem still is an awful parasitic larvae of an introduced fly. Its name is Phalaenis downsi. It, as of yet, doesn't have an accepted common name. And this fly, the adult, feeds on fruit and nectar, but it lays its eggs in the nests of breeding passerines, small breeding birds. And the fly eggs hatch, the larvae emerge from the eggs, and they enter into the nasal and head cavities of the chicks. The larvae feed on fluids inside the chicks. The larvae then emerge again out of the nares or nostrils, and the larvae continue to grow. They go through several phases, and they live at the base of the nest and feed externally on the blood from the chicks. This is devastating for the mangrove finches. We were finding every single nest that had a chick had these larvae. It had large numbers of the larvae, and it was causing extremely high mortality of chicks.
What can you do about it in your conservation work?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question, and it's one that I guess we're still trying to find the best answer. But with such a low population of mangrove finches, we have to take action at the same time. So firstly, my original job description was to run a translocation of, you know, grown-up mangrove finches to another site. We did that. Most of those birds returned home, back to their source population. Situations with other species generally show that if you continue to take enough individuals out, there's a higher likelihood they will establish. My concern back then was we didn't have enough individuals anyway to continue doing that. At the same time we were doing nest monitoring, we were seeing this appallingly high level of mortality of chicks. If birds lose a nest, as long as there's enough food, they'll relay. So we had this constant supply of eggs. We had sometimes pairs laying up to 5 or 6 clutches. And that's when I thought, you know, what we really need to work with here isn't adult birds, which are part of a very limited population, but let's work with those eggs, which we know if we don't do anything, are likely not going to survive to fledge. And that's when we initiated the head starting, which we did in collaboration with San Diego Zoo Global, because I'm not an expert in rearing these tiny little chicks that hatch out weighing as little as 2 grams. And the idea of that was to climb the trees, and these aren't like mangroves in New Zealand. We're talking here about mangroves that are over 20 meters high. And of course, the finches are nesting at the very top, at the very end of the flimsiest branches. So they make life a good challenge for us.
The significance of these finches, we should just say, beyond their significance in their own right, these were an important part of the work that Charles Darwin was doing.
Yeah, so they're one of the Darwin's finches, of which there's now 18 recognised species. However, Charles Darwin himself didn't see or record the mangrove finch. And funnily, it was actually a lot of Darwin's work more with his mockingbird samples from Galapagos, which really, you know, sort of supported his theory of evolution. But it's the finches, due to their amazing adaptions and the way that they've just diversified to specialise in different habitats, which have carried Darwin's name.
How do you describe the Galapagos Islands as they are now, and even as you've seen them over the time you've been there? You know, they've been hallowed as this precious kind of sanctuary, but they're under a lot of environmental pressure, as are so many other places. How would you describe it?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely are under a lot of pressure. They're an incredible place, and I count myself very lucky through my work to have been able to spend such extended times in the wild places of Galapagos, which is really what's just so fascinating about the islands. But, there is an increase in population. There's been a huge increase in tourism. And then, of course, there's all the support workers which are needed to be able to maintain that, which has led to an increase in the resident population. And I guess they're so fragile. Like New Zealand, the native species were adapted to such a specialised environment that, that any changes, any introduced species such as the Phalaenus fly really get out of balance and have really devastating impacts. And I think also, you know, looking at the situation now with the COVID-19 situation, which of course brought a complete stop to all tourism in Galapagos, and it's what the province relies on. It's the richest province in Ecuador, but it's over 70%, I think, of Galapagos workforce is directly related to tourism. So this situation as well for them is very stressful and causing a lot of problems there. And at the same time, maybe it's an opportunity to look at the tourism model and think about whether it can be reworked to be more sustainable.
Conservationist Francesca Cunningham is our guest. You are listening to 9 to Noon. Well, if you had been able to get back from Ecuador to New Zealand, you'd be working on projects here in New Zealand right now. And what are they?
Yes, so since 2016, I've been based back in Dunedin, and I'm there working for the Royal Forest and Bird Protection Society, where we have two local projects. One is Bring Back the Seabirds, which is focused on enhancing remnant colonies of breeding seabirds, which is still hanging on at several sites along the Otago coast. And the other one is a landscape scale restoration project focused on the Fleming and Tautoko River catchments down in the Catlins. But the key one at this time of year is our work with the Titi or Sooty Shearwaters, which right now have, well, should have, chicks in their burrows ready to fledge in early May.
Who are their predators?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, one of our key sites is out at the Sandfly Bay Wildlife Reserve on the Otago Peninsula, where we have a regionally significant colony of titi there. And we've documented, off the top of my head, I can't remember, I think it's 7 introduced predators there which frequent the colony. We've got rats, there's ferrets, there's weasels, there's stoats, there's possums, there's feral cats, there's hedgehogs. And all of those have negative impacts on the titi, their eggs and their chicks. So it's a huge challenge.
You must be particularly worried about both species at the moment. And again, I suppose this is true for conservation generally. Is it limiting people's ability to be out working on the programs that they normally work on?
Yeah, I think definitely it is. You know, there's a lot of sort of positive, I guess, wider conservation ecosystem stuff coming out of this, you know, unprecedented global lockdown and reduction and sort of human movements of, you know, improvements in air quality of a lot of areas, you know, coastal areas of animals coming back in now that humans aren't there. But at the same time, the most vulnerable species and those which now rely on some form of human interaction to protect them from invasive species or, you know, supplementary feed them, carry out some task, really will be suffering. And I think in that respect, New Zealand's done really well and showed a great example in being able to maintain some critical species conservation work as an essential service during the level 4 lockdown. Whereas unfortunately here in Ecuador, the sort of, you know, the government order, there was no time or thought even for something as critically endangered as the mangrove finch, and as a result us having to leave the field 5 weeks prior to our planned date means, based on past data, it's almost certain that the chicks that were in the nests and the eggs that were in the nest when we left will not survive, which is hugely concerning.
What happens now, Francesco? Do you anticipate being able to come back to New Zealand? Will you stay there? What's the plan?
Yeah, well, we've really sort of been in limbo. And I think, you know, special thanks to the closest New Zealand embassy situated in Bogota, Colombia, for keeping us up to date with everything. And if you'd interviewed me 2 days ago, my answer would have been, I have no idea. We're literally living day by day, knowing that someone will let us know one day when there is an option. However, it does look very promising now that it's probably the last flight there's going to be, and it's actually being put on predominantly for Australians in South America, which it looks as if New Zealanders are going to be able to get on, and that might be as soon as this coming Sunday, which is, it's great really, because it means we can get to where we should be at this time of year.
Francesca Cunningham, I was speaking to her in the Ecuadorian Andes late last week, and the really good news is she did get on that flight on Sunday and is on the way home now, arriving later today. She has been working, of course, and does work in both parts of the world, on the Galapagos Islands, trying to save rare mangrove finch chicks, and here in New Zealand working with titi, or mutton bird. So safe return, Francesca. I'm sure a lot of people are going to be very pleased to see you in person later today.